make big issue out of the fact that here I was running together with the black folks. Mm-hmm.
Now, what made you decide? You campaigned together, didn't you?
Oh, yes, yes.
What made you decide to do that?
In the book there, you'll find picture of both men.
Right.
Yeah. We campaigned together.
Was that unusual for two candidates to join forces?
It was quite unusual. Mm-hmm. It was unusual for black and white to campaign. And it was unusual to two people campaigning for the city council. Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide to do that? How did the idea come up?
Well, the idea was to bring together, actually. It's not so much to be elected. Frankly speaking, I didn't think I would be elected, mm-hmm. nominated even. But to bring together the two groups, particularly the biggest group, Poles, who were at that time the biggest group, the black one not yet, but they were big group. To bring them ideologically together. Mm-hmm. And we kept on appearing together and speaking together. Mm-hmm. So that was first experience. And on the floor of the Senate, too, an issue would come out. And generally speaking, I would always have to initiate the idea, either for or against, mm-hmm. and speak on it. But Dix always voted with me. And there we had this problem. Dix could not live in any hotel. Mm-hmm. He could not eat in any restaurant. Mm-hmm. So, and actually, everybody in the Senate would recognize him as a senator. But on the street, they wouldn't even talk to him.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, it's bad. And one incident that I might have to mention. I invited him to have a dinner with me in the evening in a hotel that I stayed at. There was a hotel known as Roosevelt Hotel. It's not there in Lansing these days, but it was then. And most of the Democrats lived there. So he would come. I was there first. He would come and sit down at my table before even the waiter. Then I told the waiter I'm waiting for my friend. So when he came and sat down, the waiter came to me and quite quietly said, "Senator, there's a telephone call for you in the lobby." Mm-hmm. Well, there were telephone calls, of course. There's mm-hmm. none other in the lobby. The small hotel. I went to the lobby and he then came and says, "No, there's not call. I wanted to tell you, we don't serve black people." I said, "Look, he's my friend. He's a senator like I am. And I cannot invite him and have a dinner with me. He's a black man. We don't serve black people. None of the hotels serve them. And if it was you, what he was saying." So I said, "Look, I don't like that. And I am not going to ask that he eat me, no." "Well," I said, "why don't you call the manager of the hotel? Maybe I'll talk to him." So the manager came in. By that time, I was quite determined, and I said, "Look, if I cannot have him as my guest, then I'll go back to that room, or the dining room, and I'll get up and I'll make a speech to the entire dining room and tell him that, look, two senators, one cannot eat here because he's black. What is this? What is you?" So he looked at me and he says, "You're going to do that?" "Yes." He thought it over and he says, "Look, please, do me a favor. We'll serve him today, but don't bring it again." Well, he served it. I couldn't object to that. I raised the question with Lieutenant Governor, and he told me that all the hotels, the managers, the owners of the hotels, have the same policy. Mm-hmm. He says he will try to convince some of them to then. Nothing doing. And Dix himself comes to me and he begged me. He says, "Please, don't make any more embarrassment situation. We'll have to adjust to it." Mm-hmm. That was first experience with Dix. My unfortunate thing, even during the campaign, we got good votes. was this in relation to this? And I regret it very much. I saw him voting for some petty little things, not important things. So I said to him, we used to call ourselves by name, I said, Charlie, why do you vote for that cheap little stuff? He says, look, I'm wasting my time here. We were at that time getting $3 a day. Do you imagine that? $1,800 a year. And he says, everybody is doing that. Well, I said, I don't think everybody is doing that, because I knew there were not everybody doing it, but not everybody was voting for some votes. And I told him, look, Charlie, there's one thing you and I cannot do. Why? You because you're black and I happen to be a leftist. They'll crucify us. That's what they did to him. Mm-hmm. Because they did call him, sent to jail for 2 years, and he was politically finished, unfortunately. But the next, I had this continue with black people. We had another campaign with Reverend Hill. He had a parish that's still there, somewhere, Harp or something, they call it. The first pastor who allowed us to use his hall for union meetings, he was black fellow, very black, very friendly. He and I campaigned. And this campaign of education, that's what I've learned a lot. Campaign can be used for educational purposes, mass educational purposes. And strictly Polish community, Hill got 60% of my vote. That never happened before and never happened since.
Hill got
60% of my Polish vote. We were running for city council. Uh-huh. Yeah. See, these are the results. But the biggest thing was in factories. Because in factories we had this constant problem. For example, in one shop was the white people didn't want admit black people to the same local unions. I said, yes, we should organize them, let them have a separate local. Mm-hmm. Well, we could not agree to that. So I was not in charge of that shop, but a man by the name of John Anders, who was one of those first five organizers, come to me, he says, a lot of Polish people there, talk to them, convince them. So I went there. And I asked them, why? Oh, they advance this kind of a reasoning. They want our women, they want this, they want something else. If we associate with them, that's what will happen, they'll be intermarriage. And I felt that my reasoning did not make headway. So I knew a black fellow, very young, handsome, looking individual, very good-looking man who was in that shop working with him. I asked him, do you know so-and-so? Oh, yes, we know very well. We are very friendly with him. So I talked to him individually. And I brought him back to the next meeting. And he would talk to me. He would say, if it comes to women, we have women. We don't need your women. We don't want your women. We have women. We are very happy around women. What are you talking about? He sold the idea. These are the examples of it. We had a number of things. At Fort, we had that kind of a thing. At Fort, what helped us in a very critical moment was Paul Robeson. He came and sang in the front of the Fort Park factory. And there were huge black people in the shop who did not leave on a strike. And he got them out when they sang. But this sort of process, when it comes to the ethnic groups, let's be very clear on one thing. It was the leftist element who was for cooperation of black people working everywhere, in every of these ethnic groups. It was the leftists who were prepared for it.
Okay.
See, they were in their own country introduced with anti-Semitism.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And they learned what it is, what it means to be divided mm-hmm. like this. And so when they came here, there was nothing new to them.
Mm-hmm.
And this way, actually, the people who are today, not all of them, but good many of them who are in the city council, who the mayor Coleman Young, we got to work together for years. Mm-hmm. And this campaigning and campaign was that educational process.
Why do you think it is that, you know, in my studies, it seems that when they talk about the ethnic groups, the two ethnic groups that had a good relationships with the blacks were Jewish and Polish. Now the Jewish, because they were persecuted, why would the Polish people be singled out as having good relationships with blacks?
Because we did the work there.
Because
we did the work there in the Polish community. There was no other explanation.
Because
we did educational work.
Okay.
It wasn't simple. That radio program I had for 3 years, and I raised all issues. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I was reelected to the Senate 5 times, I was served 5 terms. Mm-hmm. And during all that time, we had the radio program, and that was various issues. Mm-hmm. And it was these campaigns that we had together. Otherwise, there are no miracles. See, the only thing that they, it was the Polish left who learned something about racism when this anti-Semitism was raised in Poland. Mm-hmm. So they came with that stuff. But if it comes to black people were completely new to them. Mm-hmm. And we talked to them about it. Further on, many of these Polish workers would work on foundries where the black workers were. Mm-hmm. And they learned to, but was not all of them. Let me give you another example. A small shop, not very large, I forget its name now, you'll find it in the book there, I didn't organize actually. They went on a strike and they called the union office centers and organized it. It was composed of black and white, mostly Poles and black, working in the mm-hmm. shop. So when the strike took place, we had to, and it was a sit-down strike, we had to organize a kitchen committee. We had to raise food, money. So these black people who were not inside the shop, who were on the outside, had to work. And they were white, Poles, and black. And they learned to work. They got along very well. Then when the strike was over, it was a victorious strike, we had a dance. And that's for the first time they danced together. Mm-hmm. See? It took some time. It doesn't happen overnight. Mm-hmm. Because, they were affected, like every ethnic group is affected by the general campaign, ideological campaign in relation to black people, in relation to Jewish. When you have that kind of exception, why should, in the Polish community, Reverend Hill get 60% of his votes? Mm-hmm. Because he appeared with me in the Polish community meetings. Mm-hmm. He told them stories, humorous stories. He was a very interesting individual. Being a reverend man, he would tell them stories like this. He was on a train. There was a bandit trying to get hold of him. And he didn't know what to do. He first appealed to God for help, and then he discovered that he had a gun with him. And it says, Jesus, forgive me, but I can take care of it myself. You know, this sort of a thing. They liked it. It was that kind of personality. But that was work. Mm-hmm. It didn't come by itself. Mm-hmm. See? That radio that I had for 3 years mm-hmm. did its work. We had days. I spoke at 6 o'clock in the evening. We had people in Hamtramck and different parts of Polish community at this hour listening. At this hour, all other programs were, nobody listened to them. That's the result. It took a lot of hard work. Mm-hmm. And of course, lot of understanding. You have to know how to approach these people. You have to realize that they have all kinds of prejudices, foolish prejudices. You have to somewhat undermine that and point out the ridiculous. Even in the, and it's not only in the Polish community, in the Senate what I had to do. I would tell them, I said, do you know something you're talking about how we have, we the five organizers, undermined this whole community? Do you know how we undermined it? They called us on the phone and told us they're on a strike, come and organize us. Then further on, we had to explain to them this, that if you charge them of breaking windows, breaking machines, it's a foolish charge. Why don't you people go and look, go into a shop sometime and see them? Mm-hmm. I took lieutenant governor once, and I did. It was the Democratic lieutenant governor who was a lieutenant governor under Murphy, and Murphy was defeated the very time I was elected to the Senate, unfortunately, well, largely over that GM strike, because he played a very good part in Murphy. And so I said to him, there was a huge Polish banquet. And who were the two speakers? This Lieutenant Governor Nowicki's name was, and myself. He was called first to speak, and after the Polish community about for the first time they had Polish American and Lieutenant Governor, the highest office. And what he did, he repeated all these foolish charges about windows, machinery, and this. And the chairman of that banquet committee was a worker himself. He worked with General Motors. He invited me to speak. He said he wanted me to speak. And he came to me very quietly, whispered, he says, look, don't worry, don't be afraid. Take this guy to pieces, walk them. He does that kind of a nonsense, we will not stand for. I look at his face, I says, yeah, I'll see what I can do. And I realize also, say, that's where the good techs require me. If I open sharp attack upon them, I don't know, the audience may split. It was a very touchy question. So when I was called to speak after he delivered, he says, I am very happy that you people invited me to speak here, and particularly to be co-speaker with the governors, we would call them that governor. It's, well, it's sort of a dignity for me to. I only have one serious regret. I think that the lieutenant governor or governor finally fell victim to a wrong propaganda. Unfortunately, I have to correct some of those things. I don't blame him. He fell victim. There have been many people fall victim. The press reports about windows and machine and this and this and this. I said, that's not true. And I want to demonstrate that. I would invite you to join me. I'll take you to Flint. We'll go through the shops of the strike gun. I'll take you through all the shops. There will be complete security for you, and you will see. Mm-hmm. Is there any truth on it? So I said, Governor, how's that? For a minute, he was taken by surprise. And then he says, fine, I will go with you. And the big applause, he agreed to go with me. The next morning, he came in the front of my house in a big car, early at 7 o'clock in the morning. I was just waking up. And so I went with him, we went to Flint. The people in charge there gave us permission. They gave us guards, and we went into and we visited shop by shop that was on the sedan. And frankly speaking, I was surprised myself. These workers kept this place so clean and so well organized that I was amazed. Mm-hmm. After all, they were living there. Mm-hmm. So we went through. We had lunch with them there, their lunch that they had. I asked him if he would speak. He didn't want to speak. At the last place, it was around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He got up and he spoke, and he said very frankly, he says, I was badly misinformed. He says, I am happy that Senator Nowak invited me here. I'm very pleased what I saw, and I will inform my governor, and I will make a statement to the press that all these charges are completely incorrect. And he did that. He did that. And in fact, he never delivered any anti-labor speeches afterwards. So these are the things. And he was of Polish descent and a very prominent individual in the Polish community. It requires a great deal of tact, judgment, how to do that. He was also, to a degree, anti-black, too. But he was also changing on that score. Mm-hmm. It took time. I would meet him periodically at meetings. I had experience like that with a Polish bishop, Roman Catholic Church bishop. it was during the war. There was a huge banquet on the west side in my own district. They were buying a new church, new bell for the church, huge thing. Old church, very old church, huge gathering. And the first Polish-American bishop, that was another thing. These were the period when the Polish community was beginning to become a factor in the community. There were three Polish congressmen from Detroit. All three congressmen were of Polish descent that period already. So he was asked to speak. And again he spoke. And again the same damn thing. He says, he was very happy to be here. Some religious thing, and then he says, I have two things that I disagree with you people. And I want to state it, you're mistaken. You join the union and you'll all be fired because the employers will not employ you because you are in charge of being communist. You vote for the one party, and when that party is elected, you have entrance into the office of the governor. But if that party is licked, defeated you, you're out. At that time, I was not only serving third term in the Senate, but I was a floor leader of the Democratic Party in the Senate. So again, chairman of the banquet committee, a Ford worker, come to me. He was angry as hell. Oh, he wanted me to raise holy hell. I said, look, he's a bishop, remember that. Mm-hmm. In fact, when they invited me, I told him very honestly, I said, look, I was raised in the Catholic Church, but I broke the relationship for a long time with the church. And you invited me to speak at it? Yes. Do you know that? Yes, of course, we know all about you. And you invited me? Yes, okay. You have to win their confidence. I was not concealing anything. And again, when this bishop spoke, he came to me. And I debated in my mind very carefully. The job has to be done, but do it in such a way that you don't split the thing. After all, he's a bishop, you have to. So I again approach him that way. And it went over. It's a method of tactics, a method of approach.
Let me
very simple people. Uh-huh. Yeah, excuse me.
We're going to have to leave in a few minutes, so I just wanted to see if there was anything that else that you know that you could say about the Polish black relationship in terms of did it change in over the years? That did you see after the labor union? Do you think that relationship has stayed good, or has that deteriorated, and for what reason?
Well, there are two things happened. First of all, that generation of Polish community passed away.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All of them then were people who came to the United States before the war.
Okay.
I came out before that too, but I was 10 years of age. They were mostly 18 to 20 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
They passed away. You have a new generation of Poles.
So the second generation.
Mm-hmm. They already are active in the union, and they got accustomed to it. It's true that you have remnants of it.
Mm-hmm.
They do remnants of it. Because there is not enough real educational work in the union now, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. They teach them routine things like how to chair a meeting, how to take complaints, mm-hmm. routine things. But basic ideological education they are lacking very badly.
So you think the same kind of sympathy that was true because people had come from this country and experienced prejudice, that was no longer true with the second generation?
No, the second generation in many respects is better and then it's worse, in a sense. I wouldn't say it's better in what sense. They don't have the old traditions, mm-hmm. and many of the old traditions were very, very conservative. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of problems with it. The younger generation doesn't have that tradition anymore. There's also this thing about younger generation. There was quite emphasis on the part of their parents to educate their children, to send them to school, mm-hmm. to send them to not only high school but university. Let me just give you this example. This fellow Ted Radzilowski, who wrote the introduction to our book, mm-hmm. he said that generation, born in Hungary, educated here, he's a professor of historian, he initiated first, before even I met him, Association of Polish American Historians. Mm-hmm. There was something like 200 members, professors teaching history of Polish descent, some of them from Detroit, from other parts. Mm-hmm. And they are much more objective to it. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, and lately in particular, there's a great deal of interest in among that generation mm-hmm. of people that are, first of all, accustomed to academic questions. They will listen to you. They are much more objective. This example of our book. Radzilowski is teaching in Minnesota and at the university there. There are two universities there. He invited both Margaret and me there. There were a number of young, both men and women of Polish descent. You know, we sold 100 books of ours. Uh-huh. And what I was very much surprised that they accepted what we had to say, and when they saw the book, they enjoyed it. There's a new trend. The bad trend is the emigres that come from Poland now. Mm-hmm. Because first, they are educated people. They mm-hmm. all there are no such a thing as illiterate. They are then whatever the government did, they provided the real education for them. Mm-hmm. They're educated people. But they have varieties of, for example, first of all, they are impressed with tremendous wealth of the United States. When I mentioned to the fact that we have so many homeless people, they said, that's not true. In the richest country in the world, you would have homeless people. When I mentioned to them that we have millions of unemployed people, that's not true. Oh, in our Poland, we have no unemployed people, that's true. If I mentioned to them that we have 30% of our population that their income is below poverty level, how can that be? No? And they come here with one thing, how can they get rich?
Right. Yeah. They think of it as the old days.
No, you see, the old day people came here not to get rich, to learn a few dollars, go back to mm-hmm. Poland, and then use the, or when they return, they save money there. But the idea that your whole objective is just to get rich, that is not the deal with the younger generation. And that's to me, it's a revelation because mm-hmm. I grew up with a Paul Polish people badly divided. Some were leftists, most of them, many of them were leftists, and they were very dedicated old people. They were illiterate, but they were very dedicated people. The only element among them were what? There were doctors, there were lawyers, there were small business people, there were undertakers, but that was the elite, mm-hmm. and priests, of course. Mm-hmm. Now everyone who comes from Poland thinks that any time he will be a multimillionaire. Mm-hmm. It's it's a hopeless case. They will have to learn from that experience. They have a completely misconception of the situation in Poland is whatever they accomplish in the old days. They industrialize the country. They provide education for them. They put them at a high level. It's true. There's a shortage of housing.
True.
There's a shortage of goods. And the shortage is due largely because the country was reduced to ashes in the war. 6 million people were killed. Cities were destroyed. To rebuild all these things, it takes money, it takes help. But they rebuild the country, industrialize the country, regardless what it is. And so when you speak to this younger generation of Poles today, this native born here, and I bring these facts to them because I visit Poland very well, I show them the facts, they accept it. But in the old generation, it was very difficult. Those they had old conception was very difficult. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing, that's the answer to your question. At least that's how I see it.
Okay.
Now, well, I don't know, what more can I say?
Yeah, no, we're fine.